When the Wheels Come Off. Brian Cunningham's popular first book, Under the Bonnet, was a colourful and humorous collection of memories of his time as a car mechanic in the 70s and 80s. When the Wheels Come Off is a joyous return covering what he missed first time around. Cars fixed and some broken, fads and crazes, crashes and scrapes and near misses, dead ends in technology, underhand practices and downright skullduggery. It is the subject of this new book. It's called When the Wheels Come Off. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from somewhere in the UK, the author of the aforementioned tome, Brian Cunningham. Brian, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. I'm actually calling or speaking to you from Norfolk at the moment, just outside of Norwich, where it's raining and cold.
Ah, well, I won't tell you about the glistening Mediterranean there, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Norfolk, Lotus Country, indeed.
Indeed it is, yep.
So tell me a little bit about, I mean, they always say that everybody's got a book in them, and you not only have a book in you, you've now got two. I thought you covered all the ground, but there, the trials and tribulations of motor mechanics in the 70s and 80s is a rich vein of form.
Well, indeed. I mean, both the books really take us back to the times that I guess people of my generation, you know, people in their 50s and 60s will remember, when if you walked along any street in England on a Saturday or Sunday morning, you would see cars up on ramps, you'd see legs sticking out on the pavement, you'd see your dad or your uncle with the bonnet up looking at a distributor and scratching his head, you know. And they were days when people genuinely did fix their own cars, keep their cars on the road. The reason they could do that in those days was the technology was simple enough for everyone to have a go. And quite often that led to trouble, but at least everybody could give it a try. So really there are a couple of books about the nostalgia of those days when driving and motoring and fixing cars was a very different thing from what it is today.
Indeed it was. If you remember the Halfords thing, because, and I'll let you into a little secret here, because my father is, amongst other things that he's done at his time, including racing to quite a high standard, he also ran a motor accessories business in the 70s in the Midlands. And this was a time when you could, where everything comes as a standard as now. But back in the day, you know, things like chrome wheels or stereo systems or you name it, you could actually bolt them on yourselves.
Of course, and of course, those things are very different now. I remember that everybody back in the day wanted a rev counter in their car. Cars didn't come with rev counters as standard, whereas of course they all do now. But back in the day, if you wanted a rev counter, you bought one and you screwed it onto the dashboard with self-tapping screws and attached it to the distributor housing, and there you got your fancy rev counter. Same for everything. Another good example would be that nobody had alloy wheels.
Yeah.
Alloy wheels were for the super rich. Everybody's wheels were steel. And if you wanted wider wheels, which everybody did, you bought some wider steels and you had some Carlos Fandango tires fitted, you know. It was it was all very much about modifying cars. That was the point.
Well,
the thing is, we
don't even talk about that strip, you know, the strip across the front of the windscreen with perhaps your name and then your beloveds on the other side. Who could forget those?
Indeed, and there was a period of time as well where the similar thing would appear in the back window with an advertisement for something like Kenwood, who were making radio systems, or Oakley Thermonuclear Protection, which was a great one for fans of American sunglasses. So yeah, all of these things, you know, furry dice in dangling from from interior mirrors, stripes and spoilers and all of that kind of stuff was all very much in vogue at various times. But my books really are written from the perspective of a working mechanic. You know, I worked in the car dealerships. I fixed mainly Vauxhalls and Fords in the early days. I worked on Volvos as well. And a mechanic's life was always a very busy one in those days, because all these guys who were out fixing their own cars on the weekends would ultimately end up you know, breaking them. And I would generally get the call to say, I'm in terrible trouble, can you come and assist, you know. There was no such thing as a free weekend for a mechanic in those days.
But the thing was, you see, because back in the day, and everybody had the Halfords, you know, get the how-to Halfords book about a particular model, but it was a case of, back in the day, it was a case of, like you say, you would see cars up on things and pairs of legs sticking out, because these days you go to the mechanic and he goes, okay, let me hook it up to the computer, and then you get the... And off you go.
Of
because
course.
You need a degree in biometrics these days to get your car, even the windscreen wipers working.
And there's two reasons for that. One is that cars are much, much more complex machines now than they ever were back in the day. And therefore, it's often a plug-in diagnosis on a laptop computer. But it's also a deliberate thing from the car manufacturers, who quite often have had to sell new cars almost at cost because of competitive pressures, and therefore would get their profit margins from the after sales work, you know, servicing and repair of cars later on in their lives. And therefore they made a point of making it more and more difficult for the man in the street to fix his own vehicle. They did that in various ways, one of which was by having to have special tools to do what had previously been a fairly simple repair. I had quite a shock the other day. I realised that my little front-wheel drive car, hadn't had a set of spark plugs for about 50,000 miles, and I thought, I'll pop a set of spark plugs in. And when I checked up on the repair process, I had to dismantle half the front end of the vehicle, even just to get at the spark plugs.
Yes.
And you might remember the old days of, for example, a Triumph Herald, where you would open the bonnet and you'd have a vast space around the engine. You could almost get into the engine compartment and walk around, you know, and everything was very simple and straightforward to get at. So very, very different thing now, fixing cars. Nobody really, except an expert, would attempt to fix a car that was broken these days. Mm. I don't think, anyway. And certainly the days of, you know, Sunday mornings under the bonnet of the car with the engine in bits are long gone for everybody except those of a certain age who remember when we used to do those things.
Indeed. And also, in 70s and 80s, motoring was a different beast indeed, because not everything had been taken over by conglomerates. There were still some really interesting cars. And I just wrote down, whilst I'm thinking about it, a bunch of cars that, you know, immediately spring to mind when I think of 70s and 80s. So from no particular order, the Metro, Golf Hatchback, the Golf Hatchbacks, the XR3i, Princess and the TR7, names to conjure and play with, and some of those were very interesting motors indeed.
Well, they were, and the thing is about those days is that you would never mistake one car for another. So, for example, nobody would ever confuse a Vauxhall Viva with a Ford Escort. Whereas today, if you look along the street and just look at the cars, it is almost impossible to tell what car is made by which manufacturer unless you look at the badge, because everything has become standardized to the box structure, you know, four doors and a tailgate. So, you know, there isn't really the differentiation between cars anymore that there once was. And they all behave in the same way now. So cars back in the day had their own personalities, and you knew that certain cars would perform better or last longer between services or rust out quicker. You know, there's a big section in the new book about the days we used to spend scrabbling about in scrapyards, taking bits from old cars to keep ours on the road. And most of those cars were in the scrapyards because 5 or 6 years after they were born, they would rust out and fail the MOT. And again, that's something that is rarely the case now, although it still happens occasionally.
Alfa Romeo springs to mind when you mention.
Oh, yes. Alfa Romeo and early Fiats as well.
Yeah,
that's, they were notorious.
They were
anything from Eastern Europe in the old days as well. But of course, all of these brands have resolved these problems now. And I mean, let's take a brand like Skoda that was once almost
just about
a,
to
a
say
joke.
That. I was just you about know, to say
almost,
Skoda.
Yeah. Absolutely. Almost a joke back in the day. And now Skodas are some of the most reliable and best cars out on the market. So everything has changed over time. And I just thought, well, nobody has really written down much stuff about this. Mm. There are books out there about the cars of the 1970s and 80s, but there aren't really books out there about the guys who tried to keep them on the road, you know? And that's where this all came from and how the books came,
and also,
came about.
And also, it was a time... before everything became a bit corporate and everything became, you know, the customer was always right. There were some interesting characters. You may, you know, in the mechanics trade, in the car trade in general, the '70s and the '80s. It was a time of flamboyance and swashbuckling, should we call it?
Yeah, swashbuckling is a very good description. You know, it felt very much like we were working in the Wild West. I mean, I'll give you one example of that. A skilled car mechanic was very, very highly sought after. And we used to have a row with the service manager on a Friday, pack up our tools, take them home and start at the new garage down the road on the Monday morning, you know, because there was always work available and we were in high demand as skilled guys. And I think those days have really gone as well. The book's full of incidents and anecdotes as well about the various characters you'd find in the sales departments and the parts departments, and how within a car dealership or garage, there was always a state of war between the parts guys and the sales guys or the service department, you know. And there's some quite funny little anecdotes about that. The book takes, the second book there takes me through my career until the point where I stopped being a car mechanic, when I went off into the business of car sales and training and other things. And the very last chapters are to do with, for example, the days when we used to cover the motor shows at Earl's Court and at Birmingham, and stand duty, looking after the vehicles on the stands. And there's some wonderful stories within the books about those days as well.
Now, can I just say at this point, because when I did the sort of the preamble this morning with the Breakfast Show presenter, and I said car mechanics in the 70s and 80s, he went Pirani calendar, simple as that. Those were his first words. And you said the car show in Birmingham and Earl's Court were in the 70s and 80s were again different animals, and let's just say that they belong to that certain era.
Well, they do. You see, the thing is, you know, semi-nude models draped over the bonnets of E-type Jaguars was really a thing that was big in the 1960s. And by the time that I was going to motor shows, that was really already on its way out. There was less and less of that. And now, of course, it would be a totally unacceptable thing to do. But certainly it was a feature of the early days at the shows. But the shows were always... happy hunting ground for celebrity spotters. You know, I remember all kinds of celebrities coming onto the stand where I worked and looking at the cars and having photos taken with us and everything. And I met film stars from America and British television.
Go on, drop a few names, Brian.
I'll drop a name. Here you go. I bore my children to death by telling them that I once had lunch with Joanna Lumley.
Yep.
And it's a true story. And she was the most wonderful person. She just came and sat down in front of me in our staff lunch area and chatted away to me like we were old friends. Very, very lovely
was
person,
this,
very
was this,
genuine.
Was this Joanna Lumley sort of purdy 1970s, or was it incarnation?
It was post Purdy.
Okay.
It was post Purdy,
pre-ab
fab, yeah. And but what a lovely person she was. And I met James Coburn, and I met Rowan Atkinson, and all kinds of people who were there looking at the cars. So the whole thing was a wonderful experience. I mean, right from the day when I first left home as a 16-year-old to be an apprentice car mechanic, all the way through to the last days when I was working at the motor shows before my career changed. And then, you know, 40 years passed, and I thought, actually, I've still got a lot of memories of these times, and perhaps other people might be interested in reading about them.
And in a world,
and that's how the books came along.
In a world where everything is chips and computers and diagnostics, back in the day, did you, as a swashbuckling James Coburn-type gunslinging figure of the motor mechanic trade, did you have your own set of tools, you know, the spanner, the wrench that never left your side?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, every mechanic in those days would swear that he or she could fix a car with, you know, a screwdriver, a hammer, a decent hammer, and that would be about all you'd need, you know, because it was a fairly simple thing to do. I had a tool that was the most sort of jealously guarded piece of kit in my toolbox, and we used to call it the listening stick. See, every car mechanic has a listening stick, and they're all very different. And what they are is a tool of some sort that you can use to put against an engine, a running engine, and listen with your ear. I used a long screwdriver. Other people use, you know, a piece of lead pipe or anything of those that type. And it really acted like a stethoscope that a doctor would have. So if you had an engine that had a ticking noise or a bearing that was running dry, you'd use your listening stick to listen to the engine, and you'd be able to diagnose exactly what's going on inside it, just like a doctor can listen to your heartbeat with a stethoscope. So my listening stick was my key piece of kit that I had in the toolbox.
The listening stick sounds like something that's escaped from, I don't know, Lord of the Rings or Arthurian. Have you bought your listening stick?
Have you got your listening stick? Yeah, exactly, yeah. And so there you go.
And also, was there a car that would you know, that used to come into the, be towed in or scrunch into the forecourt, and you'd go, oh blimey, was there a particular make? Was it the Princess? Was it the Austin Allegro? Was it, I don't know, yeah, any of the aforementioned 1770s or 1780s Skodas, for example?
Yeah, well, I suppose the Austin Allegro, poor old thing, got a terrible bad press, you know, and yeah, they did tend to break quite a bit, but then so did everything else in those days. In many ways, the Austin Allegro got a reputation that it possibly didn't deserve. It was a fairly boring looking piece of kit that came out of the last days of the British Leyland world, you know. But I mean, Austin Allegros didn't break any more or less often than anything else in those days. The thing is about the 1970s and 80s, if you set out on a journey, there was a very good chance that you'd end up pulled up on the side of the road with the bonnet up and steam coming out of the engine.
Indeed.
You know, or you know, it was a you know, not a daily occurrence, but you would expect it to happen at some point. Whereas the thing about modern cars is nobody expects them to break ever.
Mm.
You know, you expect to be able to do your journey without problem, and that's, you know, all of the technology changes have made that possible. But I remember my father used to take us all on holiday in an Austin 1100. Now, there were five of us kids, and mum and dad in the front and five kids in the back, no seat belts. And off we'd head to Wales or somewhere, and halfway there, you know, he'd have the car pulled up in the lay-by with the bonnet up and steam coming out of it, and us all having a picnic on a table somewhere with wasps attacking us, you know. So these are the kinds of memories that most people from that era had of travelling in cars.
Halcyon days, though, because remember, they used to say, if you're going on a long journey, like 2 hours up the road, then make sure the car is properly serviced before setting out the tyre tread, test the brakes after going through water and all, public information films, etc.
Absolutely, yeah. And, of course, you would also regularly do things like top up engine oil, you know, check the level with a dipstick, you top up your fuel and your coolant and everything else. And not many people do those things now. They might put some fluid in the washer jets and that'd be about it. But the number of times that the modern driver has to lift the bonnet are very few and far between.
Brian, I'll let you into a secret because you don't know this, but my claim to fame here is that I am a car breaker. I should be a test pilot. As I said before, I'm actually writing a small series of essays because, as I said before, my father was a racing driver of some repute, never had a serious accident, and I reckon he did a Faustian pact with the devil so that he could get through his racing career without a scrape, and I would get all his bad luck in cars. So I have been through unbreakable Range Rovers. I have an X5 with a gearbox in a mechanic somewhere. I am currently trying to put bits on a Land Cruiser, which, as you know, never break in their lives. You know, when the tribesmen come out of the desert, they're always driving Land Cruisers. So I am a man who spends half his time, you know, poring over bits, trying to find bits, topping up fluid, etc., etc. So exactly, I can absolutely relate to this book.
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. Okay.
What was your what was your favourite car there at the Vauxhall? Vauxhall, the Vauxhall Vivas, etc., the Vectors, they were somewhat misunderstood, weren't they, Vauxhall in the 70s and 80s, because they had a great racing career, and there were some pretty good examples of Vauxhalls thundering around the high roads and back roads of the UK in the 70s and early 80s.
There were. I mean, I liked the second version of the Vauxhall Viva, what we called the HB model of the Viva, which I thought looked the best of them all. It was certainly, I think, the most iconic of the Viva range. The Vauxhalls were never quite as cool as Fords, you know, the Ford Escort Mexicos and things like that, and then the XR3s and XR2s. I don't think Vauxhall ever really quite managed to compete in the cool stakes. But I'll tell you the car that I remember with most joy from that time.
Please do.
And it was a car that my friend's father owned, and it was a Triumph Vitesse. And it looked like a Triumph Herald, but it had a straight six engine. And it was a lovely, lovely little sports car. And I remember thinking, one day I'll own a Triumph Vitesse. And I never have, but maybe one day I will.
Well, hopefully you'll be able to. I just got a message in from William saying, "Morning, Giles. My uncle, Jack Crossland, was the founder of Crossland Filters back in the day, who then sold the business to Lucas Parts, etc." So, cheers.
There you go.
From William, there you go. Then it's a small world. It's Crossland Filters.
Crossland Filters. How many Crossland Filters have I fitted in my life? Hundreds, if not thousands. There you go. It is a small world.
It's a small world, exactly. Well, the book is called When the Wheels Come Off. It's by Brian Cunningham, who we're speaking to today. Brian, if people want to find more information about you or about the book, is there a website, their social media, or do they just follow a trail of oil and greasy rags?
follow a trail of oil. Now, look, the History Press is the publisher of the two books. They have an excellent website where you can look up not only my book, but many, many other really good books about motoring and other subjects. Or you can find me on Amazon and through the usual sources.
The book is called When the Wheels Come Off. It's by Brian Cunningham, who we've been speaking to today. Brian, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you too. Bye-bye.